Hey, welcome everybody. This is the State of the CIO, where we talk with America's top IT leaders about the changing role of technology in the C-suite. I'm your host, Dan Kelly. Hey everybody, this is Dan Kelly here, State of the CIO podcast. Thanks for joining in today. We've got an outstanding guest. His name is Bill Schmarzo, Chief Innovation Officer of Hitachi Vantara. Hey Bill, how you doing?
Hey Dan, I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Excellent. I always start these interviews out by sharing just some key topics that we plan to discuss today, as well as a little bit of background about yourself. And this episode is really going to be focused on this concept of big data and what you do about it and how you get people's heads wrapped around it. And Bill, you're an expert in this space, no doubt. I also would like to point out that your title is called Chief Innovation Officer versus Chief Information Officer, right?
Yes.
Would you mind maybe explaining a little bit about your background to the audience, as well as maybe jump into why that title means something to you versus the old classic CIO?
Yeah. So, and we do have a classic CIO in the organization.
Yeah.
It's just getting back to your point about data. Most organizations, the vast majority of organizations, maybe nearly all of them, really don't have an appreciation for data. Data as a source of innovation, not as a item to minimize the cost of. And so, as you mentioned, Dan, my background is I've always been in the data space and I've always been in the analytics space. And in fact, my passion for analytics probably started when I was in my teenage years and I used to play Strat-O-Matic baseball. And I used to love the idea that if you knew stats somewhat and you knew what the cards were saying, you knew what players to go after and you knew how to situate, it just gave you an unfair advantage if you had any sort of analytic capabilities. So I dominated our neighborhood Strat-O-Matic baseball to the chagrin of all my friends. They stopped playing with me because I'd always beat them, sometimes mercilessly. So I've always been a data analytics person throughout my entire life. And I've been fortunate. I've seen it go through ebbs and flows where, the data warehouse BI promise became so large and then it just under-delivered. And then I happened to be at one of the very first implementations of a data warehouse. I was at Procter & Gamble, and we put our first one in place in the 1980, 87, 88 timeframe, taking Walmart's electronic point-of-sale data, which at that time was big data. And I know if you had 10 gigabytes of data, people were like astonished, right? So
yeah,
I've had a long history of exposure to data. Probably my turning point for my appreciation of data was when I was at Yahoo, and I was the vice president of advertiser analytics there. And learned a lot of new stuff, which really actually forced me to unlearn a lot of old stuff in order to move forward. So long-winded answer, I have a lot of experience in the data analytics space. I wouldn't consider myself an expert. I don't know if anybody who's an expert. I have experience. We learn through those experiences. But sometimes your learnings can get in the way. You have to be willing to let go and unlearn. You can't climb a ladder and not let go of that rung below you at some time. And so sometimes you got to let go of concepts you think are true. And that's probably been the biggest challenge that I have personally faced. And I think it's the biggest challenge organizations face. They get this frame, this mindset about this is how we're going to think about data. And they burn that into the ROM and don't really have the ability to back themselves up and say, wait a second, this is a different conversation. Anyway, that's my background and why I love data and analytics.
I love it. I mean, well, I know you've got over 30 years of experience in this.
Yeah, I started when I was like 10, right? So
yeah, it's great. I love it. Yeah. You're in it with Hitachi now. You served as the CTO of big data at Dell EMC, I believe. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And then obviously, as you just described at Yahoo. I'd be curious, before we get into some tactical takeaways for the audience to hop in and engage right away. You spoke a little bit about this concept of big data and how that it's the same term, but the concept and how you apply it has changed drastically, even just in the last 10 years. So how do you explain what's changed and what people should be doing about it now, specifically when you're talking to your senior executives?
So Dan, you're right that big data is more, it's not a term, it's a concept. And it's probably a bad name. And what big data is enabling organizations to do, especially the CIO, is to change their role with respect to the business leaders. Instead of being a repository for the organization's data and developing reports, regulatory reports and compliance reports and management reports to report on the status of the business, a select number of CIOs are realizing that this data is actually a source of value. And I can use this data in cooperation and collaboration with the business stakeholders to help drive their key business initiatives. For example, you might have a business initiative about how do we reduce unplanned operational downtime by 5%. It's worth, you know, $45, $80 million a year, whatever it's worth, right? The CIO could come in and say, okay, you're trying to reduce unplanned downtime. Here are the data sources we have that can help do that. And oh, by the way, here are the other data sources, right, where we could put sensors, where we could put other things, right? Build an instrumentation strategy for how you can help to do that. And so what big data has done, it started to change this mental model that data is a cost to minimize. Instead, it's an asset to be exploited to help drive the organization's business initiatives. The popular term is saying we need to become data-driven. No, right? No, not data-driven. You need to be value-driven based on the value of the insights about your customers, your products, and your operations buried in that data. When we focus the conversation not on data, but on value, we start to get that click. And it really has to be driven by the CIO. The CEO may have the vision, but it's up to the CIO to really deliver on that.
And just to be clear, are you talking about the chief innovation officer or the chief information officer? Just to be clear.
Yeah, I'm talking about the chief information officer. The chief innovation officer is kind of a wackadoodle, so no one really cares about them. But the chief information officer and sometimes the chief data officer, they own this valuable data asset.
Right.
And they're the ones who need to figure out how do we get value from that?
You know, a lot of this is driving this economic value conversation and having IT be a profit center versus a cost center. If you were advising a company that was beginning their journey, they know they have this massive data set, right? You can pick any industry you want, but getting a little bit more tangible for people to wrap their heads around, how would you suggest someone get started in this space? Not only just making a business case internally, what should their guiding principles be and how they're going to use the data?
There's the basic philosophy that when you try to determine the value of data, the value of the data is not in trying to sell it, obviously, but it's in how you use it. Where you start is really quite simple. It's very simple. What is your company's strategic and business initiatives over the next 12 months? What's the business trying to accomplish? You know, reduce customer attrition, reduce unplanned downtime, reduce inventory costs, improve new product introductions, right? Organizations have business initiatives. If they're public companies, they're usually published in your annual report, president's letter, usually talks about them, right? That's where the CIO, the chief information officer, needs to start the conversation. What's important to the business and how can the data that I have help you do that? Now, there's a process here because the CIO is sitting on a wealth of data. We call it a swamp of data because not all data is of equal value. And in fact, that's the reason most data lakes are failing miserably. Everybody just throws all the data into it and says, no, hey, go forth and be fruitful. When in reality, you just need a small number of those data sets. What are the most important data sets? Let's don't clutter up this data lake and turn it into a swamp of junk. Let's actually figure out what we need. And so there needs to be a very concentrated conversation between the business stakeholders and the problem they're trying to solve and the IT CIO who has this data and hopefully some analytic capabilities who can help provide that. What we do is once we've identified that key business initiative, we do two really simple things. Number one, we identify the stakeholders who either impact or are impacted by that initiative. So if you're trying to improve customer retention, you're going to have sales and marketing and customer service and maybe finance, just a few groups, right? And then what we do for each of those groups is we identify the decisions they are trying to make in support of that business initiative. We focus on the decisions. And here's the beautiful part about decisions. First off, every stakeholder knows what decisions they're trying to make because they've been trying to make them for years, decades, hell, generations. Who are my most important customers? Who's at risk? What products should I likely sell them? Right? They've been asking these questions since we were cavemen trying to sell you another new, a new dinosaur, right? So the beauty is that stakeholders know the decisions and they know which ones are most important and they know which ones are most valuable. When you bring the data science process into it, the decisions haven't changed. But by virtue of the data and analytics, the answers have changed. And so what we find is we bring the business stakeholders who subject matter experts who know the decisions and understand how to try and make those decisions. We bring them together with the data scientist and data engineer. And that's where the magic happens. It couldn't be more simple.
Sounds like a simple problem to have that, right? If you had to pick three of the most common mistakes you see organizations of every size make, when they begin this journey, or maybe they're even on phase two of three of this journey. What are those biggest mistakes that people make right now?
The first mistake is they don't focus on what's important to the business. You don't form a common language between the IT organization and the business. The CIO and the CEO aren't talking the same language. So the first major problem is we don't focus on what's important to the business. The second one, I think, is adopting a culture where all ideas are worthy of consideration. What you're going to find out as you start to drill down on these decisions, the people who have the most insights about the decisions don't sit in a mahogany row. They're not the SVPs. Yeah. It's right. The front lines, right? And so you need to have a process that empowers the front line. The world of AI is going to blossom in organizations when you empower the front line. So the mahogany rows, SVPs of the world need to realize that they may not know the most about what makes customers happy in spite of what they think and how well they're paid, but it's really empowering the people who are close to the action. So that's the second biggest one, is you got to empower the people who are at the grassroots. Third one is you don't put in place a governance process to ensure that you are building out your data and analytic assets one use case at a time. You get the first one done, you get success, and we see paybacks measured in months, count on one hand kind of months. The payback on these projects are ridiculous, right? And so everybody wants to do them. And so all of a sudden, you've had one success and everybody wants to pile in. Everybody throws all the data back in the data lake and you got junk again. So you need to have a methodical process, a governance process. It's not just run by the CIO, but it's run by the business as well, who is basically trying to figure out what are the next use cases we're going to go after? What are the data assets that we can reuse across these use cases? And what are the analytics we're going to build and reuse those as well? Because we don't want to build orphaned analytics. And that's the real key, the economic potential of data and analytics. If I build out my data lake one use case at a time, once I put my point of sales data into my data lake, and I've got an index and catalog and all things, I can use that same data set over and over and over again at a marginal cost equal to zero. And if I build my analytics as reusable, composable analytic modules, I can use them over and over again. And so that has the benefit of reducing the marginal cost as I go use case to use case and accelerating time to value and de-risking projects. So that governance process becomes so key. And most organizations, they get that first success, mission accomplished, and they don't realize that you just left all the best parts on the floor.
Understood. That's a great insight. Remember, I said I had some tactical questions. I got to throw one out right here because you just addressed one of them. A general statement, but I'd like to you just give me your honest answer. And I'm not a data scientist. I mean, full transparency. But as I think about this, right, I think about a use case to a specific set of data. Is it best practice to create a single data set for a single use case problem and then reset? Or is it using multiple use cases with clear objectives against one single data lake?
We build our data lake and our analytic assets, these analytic modules, we call analytic solution cores in our language, that they're reusable. We build them one use case at a time. What I mean is, so we'll pick a use case and let's say, oh, we need to improve customer retention. Okay, we're going to need these four data sets. We go through a process of talking to the stakeholders, understand the decisions, a data scientist then tries to map that to the data sets. And we say, oh, these are the four data sets we're going to need, right? We've gone through some sandboxing. And so those four data sets go into the data lake. And maybe we're going to build a customer propensity score on their likelihood to a try. And maybe we're going to build a customer value score. So we got those two analytic modules and we got those in our there. So
right.
They're there. Now we go to our second use case. And the second use case is, how do I improve cross-sell? I'm going to release new products. And we look back at our data lake and say, okay, of those four data sets we put in, we can reuse three of them, but we need to add this one on consumer comments. And so we're going to bring that in. And those two modules we got, I can reuse this one, but I need to build another one to do this on propensity to buy model. And so you can start seeing that you can methodically build out your data lake and your analytic modules in one use case at a time, where each use case has a phenomenal ROI, and it starts to pay for it.
I mean, the answer is yes, right? You're creating individual data sets, which in modern terms, we're calling data lake, to focus on a specific problem. A follow-up question I have is, do you ever see, as you go walk down that journey, right? You were talking about these different, do you ever see a situation where clients have degrading value from that same set, AKA a law of diminishing returns, where you're losing insights from your initial use case and not applying them to a new use case? Or how do you help clients with that? We see this a lot with our clients. Again, we don't play in this space, but we help find the right suppliers for the client. However, talking about some of their key problems, I hear this a lot saying we're losing insights by being very, very niche in specific use cases. And how do we blend them all together so we don't lose any insights? Maybe you could speak to that.
Sure. So the use cases, maybe I be clear on one thing. So when we do a use case, we don't necessarily build a specific data set for that use case. We just prioritize putting those data sets into the data lake. So those four data sets are going to go in. We're going to catalog, we're going to index, we're going to put metadata management all around them, right? We really invest in assets because those are the three or four data sets that are most important for that use case. And now they're there. So now I can reuse them again, second, third, or fourth use case. And sometimes what will happen on the fourth use case, you might find something that says, well, I can actually improve the accuracy of those data sets by doing some different data engineering techniques. Well, the first, second, and third use case that use those same data sets just got more effective for free.
Right.
And on the analytics, this is where it really gets powerful. Analytic modules, the more they get used, the better they get. Analytic modules are an asset that don't depreciate with use. They actually appreciate. And so if you're reusing the same analytic models over and over again, and by the fourth time you use it, one of your big, giant, big brain data scientists says, well, I can deploy a deep reinforcement neural network to do blah, 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 and I can improve the accuracy of that model by 1%. Every application, every use case that used that module just got 1% better for free. So you see this asymptotic improvement. This, by the way, this is the secret to Google's TensorFlow success. Google, the single most important technology inside of Google might be TensorFlow, which is their AI machine learning framework, right? Deep learning framework. And what do they do with their single most important technology? They open source it. What the hell? They're giving it away. You know why? Because every lunkhead who uses that makes that module, that software more effective. And the organization that knows how to monetize TensorFlow better than anybody else in the world is, guess who? Google.
Right.
So this idea that you can build these assets and appreciate and value, it's something that we really have embraced in our team. And we are building these kind of assets because across all of our Hitachi business units, we can start driving lots of different value by having these modules. The more they get used, the smarter they get. It's a great challenge. It's a lot of fun and interesting to see this come to work. And I'm hopeful at some point in time that I can, if I can actually prove out this thing, that I will actually qualify for a Nobel Prize in economics. So that is my goal. So
you heard it here, everyone.
Yeah, so hit me with a big old medallion right here. Dude. If I win it, I'm going to wear it everywhere.
I love it. You know, a key phrase popped in my mind as you're explaining it here, and maybe this already exists, but what you're explaining to me almost is like machine learning as a service. Is that right?
Yes, that's where a lot of organizations are going.
I've never heard that phrase used, though, before. Am I just not looking in the right places, or did I just come up with something? I don't know. It feels like as a service, yeah?
Yeah, no, we actually are working on we call it data science as a service.
Okay.
And so all the capabilities we have, yeah, it's customers don't want to be in the analytics business. They want to be in the transportation business or hospitality business or healthcare business. And so what they want is they want analytic modules that they can quickly and easily deploy that learn and grow, but it's their data that's very unique to them. So while they're willing to have analytic modules that they can share with other people, especially it's almost an open source kind of model where everybody's contributing to making it better, but the organization that's going to win are the ones that figure out, how do I use that with my data to derive new value? And that's what we're learning from the Google experiences. You know, anybody can use TensorFlow, but no one monetizes TensorFlow as well as Google does.
Right. If you're a CIO that we're listening right now and you want to take action and you say, you know, if nothing else, I want to do a proof of concept. How would you get started and how would you sell that? Everybody's got to write business cases. Most of our listeners are in the Fortune 1000, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's got business cases. Everybody's bored of them. How do you get most efficient and effective with that?
Here's what we do for this. And so this is a technique I've been using for a very long time. Is first thing, of course, is you pick a problem to go after.
Yeah.
And you need to find within the business side somebody who's really willing to unlearn what they've done in the past and embrace a new way. So you pick a business problem, the CIO and the business stakeholders join arms, and we run what we call a value engineering workshop. It takes about 2 weeks to run one of these things. But what we do is we interview all the different stakeholders to understand, you know, what the benefits are, the impediments, but really to understand the decisions. We consolidate all those together. We share those and we aggregate into those because a business initiative will break down into multiple use cases. We tend to see that they break into 8 to 14 different use cases that comprise that. And then we bring everybody together for a four-hour workshop. And you can see on my board back here, we lots of whiteboards and we're doing lots of brainstorming and we're prior. And the whole idea of the workshop is to gain organizational consensus on what are the high priority use cases to go after. You bring everybody in so everybody's voice is heard. So all ideas are worthy of consideration. You identify, you validate, you value, and you prioritize the use cases. Because if you don't bring everybody in, what kills these projects more than technology is passive aggressive behavior. Is that you didn't bring somebody in, their voice wasn't heard, and they're going to get you. So we do that. It takes a lot of work. You do all this work, this 2 weeks of work before we ever put science to the data. But out of these things, we have a tool we call the Hypothesis Development Canvas. And I can share you the link on that. It's freely available to anybody. It's a design thinking tool we use that basically provides all the details our data scientist needs before they ever start the data science project. So out of that envisioning workshop, we have not only a concrete idea of what problem we're trying to solve, but we have business and IT alignment to do that. Then we go to a proof of value, not a proof of concept. We're not trying to prove the damn thing works. We're trying to prove we can actually deliver value. We can solve that problem.
Right.
And that can take 12 weeks where you now bring in the client's data. You take this problem, you start actually the data science team with their big brains and the data engineers with their feature engineering stuff. And they start doing all this really cool stuff. At the end, you say, okay, we can actually solve that problem. We think that problem will save you $28 million a year, just in that one use case. Deliver that, governance in place so you don't declare victory too soon. Move on to the second use case. Every use case, 28 million, 36 million, 20, no, 14 million. Every use case has got a positive ROI. It's like friggin' printing money. One of my most successful projects in a previous life was at a casino. And the casino had a wealth of data. Let's just say that they were making all kinds of comp decisions about who to give comps to in a blanketed manner. And once we went through, they realized that not everybody gets treated the same way. And trust me, it was literally like printing money. They just kept use case after use case, more money, more money, more ways to monetize all that player and guest data. It isn't that hard as long as you take a disciplined approach, you drive that collaboration, and you look at data and analytics as unique assets, that the more that they are used, the more valuable they get.
And this is industry agnostic, I know. I'd be curious if you have any insights, if you think there's one or two industries that have the biggest opportunity, because maybe they weren't the first movers, but there's a lot there that could be served. Any thoughts come to mind there?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I think the industries that I think have done the, who are furthest along are the sort of the digital media marketing companies. They sprinted out financial services, they sprinted out retail, sprinted out. But now we're starting to see healthcare trying to catch up. We're starting to see industrial companies of all different sizes and shapes trying to catch up. And I think the whole IoT craze is really all about how do we help those industrial companies sort of get caught up. Universities, I don't want to talk about governments. I mean, governments could use a whole shitload of help. But I do think it is agnostic. But if you don't have a culture of collaboration, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't. You just can't do a lay on. You can't say, okay, everybody now is going to use a machine learning framework. So big deal.
Right. It all comes down to people, doesn't it? And change management.
It all does.
Yeah. That's excellent. Bill, this has been an outstanding conversation. Are there any final thoughts you want to leave with the audience?
Yeah. Don't overcomplicate it. Keep it simple. It will get complicated enough once we get into the bowels of implementation. But if we stay laser focused on the value creation, it knocks aside a lot of things. And what you're going to find in almost every organization, if you focus on your customers and sometimes your customers' customers, that gives you that true north you need to really drive your projects. Because at the end of the day, the only people that have ink in their pen, the only people who are actually creating value are the customers and the customers' customers.
Amen.
Amen, brother.
He's MBA. He just got...
Cheers. Done.
Saved you a 4-year degree right there. actually, my one last question. I always ask people, if you could speak to yourself, 20 years ago or so, you pick a number, at the beginning of your career, and what would you tell yourself? What advice would you give yourself as you look back, and what made you most successful, or maybe some mistakes you wouldn't make again?
What I tell myself is, don't be afraid to make mistakes. You got to be fearless. You got to sometimes take projects, take on assignments, take on jobs, that fail. I've failed a number of times. I've been fired / laid off 3 times in my life. Failure is only a failure if you only don't learn from it. And so what I would tell myself is, if you're not failing enough, you're not pushing the edges enough. So don't be afraid to step outside. Take failure as a way to learn and grow again. But that's what I probably tell myself is, don't be afraid to fail. In fact, if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough.
You're probably not trying. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really sage advice. Thank you, Bill. I'll remind myself of that every day. I'll try to fail more often.
Yeah, just, sometimes you don't have to be so dramatic on the failures, right? But it's okay. Yeah. Kind of gets back to, I come to work wherever I've been, willing to be fired for what I believe in.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've gotten my wish. But you know what? You got to be true to yourself. You got to be true to your passion. At the end of the day, when they finally stick me in the ground, they're going to say, hey, he always believed in this.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I've always believed in the power of the customer. My source of energy, and by the way, the source of most of my ideas, in fact, the source of all my ideas, comes from my interaction with customers, both corporate customers as well as students. I look at my students as my customers as well. And they're always teaching me a lesson. Always. Now, sometimes I'm not listening. I don't have my ears open. But they're always telling you something. So every now and then you got to kind of pause. And my mom used to always tell me, 2 ears, 1 mouth. Listen, pause, learn. So anyway, that was too much philosophy for a Monday, I guess.
No, that's very, very thoughtful. I appreciate that, Bill. Thank you very much. If people want to get in touch with you, Bill, how would they be able to do that?
Oh, you can find me splattered all over LinkedIn and Twitter. I don't hang on Facebook very much. I find there are trolls who don't like me on Facebook. I actually have LinkedIn as probably a great place to share comments and ideas. I write blogs, a lot of blogs. I probably write 1 or 2 each week because I'm always working with customers. I'm always learning new things and I try to share those. And so again, follow me on Twitter, Schmarzo. There's only one Schmarzo, so it's not hard to find me. And if you stumble on other Schmarzos, those are my kids, and they'll point you back to me anyway. So
that makes it really convenient. Yeah. Other than Dan Kelly, there's about 1 million of them in the world.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, everybody, if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you watch the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon, Bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Dan. This was great. I appreciate it.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening. If you got value from today's conversation, please share this podcast with one person you think who would enjoy it. For show notes, episodes, and more, please visit thenegotiator.guru. Look forward to hearing from everyone soon. Thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.